Please turn in your Bibles to Isaiah chapter 52, and we'll read from verse 13 to Isaiah chapter 53, verse 12. This section in Isaiah has been called the jewel in the crown of Isaiah's theology. So let us hear and see this jewel in his crown. Behold, my servant shall act wisely. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind. So shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them they see, and that which they have not heard they understand. Who has believed what they heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? For he grew up before him like a young plant, and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. He was despised and rejected by men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And as one from whom men hide their faces, he was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned every one to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. He was oppressed and he was afflicted, yet he opened not his mouth. Like a lamb that is led to the slaughter, and like a sheep that before its shearers is silent, so he opened not his mouth. By oppression and judgment he was taken away. And as for his generation, who considered that he was cut off out of the land of the living? Stricken for the transgression of my people. And they made his grave with the wicked, and with a rich man in his death, although he had done no violence, and there was no deceit in his mouth. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He has put him to grief. When his soul makes an offering for sin, he shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The will of the Lord shall prosper in his hand. Out of the anguish of his soul he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. Therefore I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong, because he poured out his soul to death, and was numbered with the transgressors. Yet he bore the sin of many, and makes intercession for the transgressors. One of the oldest pieces of graffiti that we have from the ancient world is from the 2nd century AD. It's a picture of a young man called Alexamenos worshipping a donkey-headed figure on a cross. The inscription under the picture reads, Alexamenos worships his God. Can you see it? A donkey-headed figure on a cross, and this man standing beside it, worshipping. The graffiti was apparently meant to mock a Christian called Alexamenos for his faith in a crucified Savior. That's how the world then and now often thinks of the Christian faith. As a bit of a joke, what foolishness to worship a crucified Jew on a cross. Crucifixion in the ancient world was the vilest of deaths, The word crucifixion was not to be used on the lips of a Roman citizen. It was like a curse word. The cross spoke of sin and shame, guilt and weakness, death. Hardly things educated people would occupy themselves with. Hardly something people would boast in. And yet Christians in the ancient world not only talked positively of Christ's crucifixion, they boasted in it, which made their faith rather preposterous. Hence the graffiti, Alexamenos worshipping his god, a donkey-headed figure on a cross. Clearly the artist wanted to mock the foolishness of Christianity. And yet for Christians then and now, the crucified Christ, it's not foolishness, it's wisdom. It's not preposterous, it's wondrous. Don't we sing, "When I survey the wondrous cross on which the Prince of Glory died, my richest gain I count but loss and pour contempt on all my pride." What is foolishness to the world is wisdom to the Christian. It's the wisdom of God. It's what Paul says in 1 Corinthians 1, verse 27 and 28. "But God chose what is foolish in the world to shame the wise. God chose what is weak in the world to shame the strong. God chose what is low and despised in the world, even things that are not, to bring to nothing things that are." And that is what is at the heart of the Christian gospel, an enigma. What is foolishness to the world, a crucified Jew on a cross, is wisdom to the Christian. It's the wisdom of God. It's not preposterous. It's wondrous. And that's the lesson that Israel had to learn as God introduced them to his servant. Because here was an enigmatic figure, someone who at first they would not understand, but someone that they needed to understand and believe in if they were to be saved. Do you remember last week we saw how God promised to raise up a shepherd Messiah to bring them back to the land? And we saw how God was going to orchestrate history with Cyrus being that surprising shepherd Messiah, the king of Persia. Someone who they would at first reject because he wasn't who they would have chosen as their shepherd Messiah to take them back to the land. And it's the same with the servant in Isaiah. This is the figure, the person that we've been waiting for all along. It's the person that Cyrus was a type of, a shadow of. Because Cyrus could only bring them back to the land. He couldn't bring them back to God. And that's why they really needed to understand who the servant was. Because they needed to get back to God, not to the land, if they wanted to be saved. And so in chapter 42 and 43 and 48, God starts to say he's going to do a new thing. And that new thing is connected to the servant. Isaiah calls him the arm of the Lord. It's the picture of God rolling up his sleeve and flexing his muscle. It's a picture of God coming in power and strength to rescue his people out of exile. That arm is his servant. And if they wanted to be saved, then the servant was someone that they needed to understand and believe in. And yet, when the servant appears in Isaiah, he's not exactly who they would have chosen. He's a bit like Cyrus. He's a surprising shepherd Messiah. He's not exactly a picture of strength, even though his name is the arm of the Lord. He's not exactly what you would call a savior. Just come with me back to chapter 42 and you start to see this picture of him being built up. Chapter 42, verse 1. "Behold my servant whom I uphold, my chosen one in whom my soul delights. I will put my spirit upon him and he will bring justice to the nations. And then we see this picture of him. He will not cry aloud or lift up his voice or make it heard in the street. A bruised reed he will not break. A fainting, burning wick he will not quench. He is humble, though determined. He will not grow faint or be discouraged till he has established justice in the earth and the coastlands wait for his law. And then in chapter 49, we see him again. His name is Israel. His mouth is like a sharp sword. He himself is a polished arrow. God is going to shoot him into the battle at a moment that he chooses to strike the enemy. But then in verse 4, we see that this servant is very human. He's despondent at what he's done. I have labored in vain. I've spent my strength for nothing and vanity. So he finds himself discouraged, and yet in the midst of his discouragement, he's also a man of faith. Yet surely my right is with the Lord, and my recompense with my God. And then in chapter 50, verse 5 and 6, we see him again. The Lord has opened my ear, and I was not rebellious. I turned not backwards. I gave my back to those who strike, and my cheeks to those who pull out the beard. I hid not my face from disgrace and spitting. Here is a servant who will be attacked, who will be insulted. And now we come to chapter 53, the fourth song about the servant. And we find in verse 3 that he is despised and rejected, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. There's the enigma, the arm of the Lord. Weak, despised, rejected. But what looked weak and foolish in the world's eyes and in Israel's eyes was God's strength and wisdom to save his people and transform the world. And that is what we will see tonight. God saving his people through judgment on his suffering servant for the transformation of the world. That's the enigma. The exile was never going to purify Israel from their sin, though it was a judgment on them. God was going to have to do a new thing to purify them from their sin. This new thing was an enigma. God would save his people through a suffering servant. And that's how this passage begins in chapter 52, verse 13 to 15, with the enigma of the suffering servant. Behold, my servant shall act wisely, or my servant shall prosper. He shall be high and lifted up and shall be exalted. As many were astonished at you, his appearance was so marred beyond human semblance, and his form beyond that of the children of mankind, so shall he sprinkle many nations. Kings shall shut their mouths because of him. For that which has not been told them, they see, and that which they have not heard, they understand. Do you see the enigma? Begins with the servant's exaltation, verse 13, and then it moves to his humiliation, verse 14, where he's pictured as more monster than man in his physical appearance because of the violence done against him. Yet there's the enigma. This marred, mangled man sprinkles the nations like a priest sprinkling blood on the altar to atone for their sins. And in that act of being marred and sprinkling, he stuns kings into silence. The reference to kings here speaks of wisdom. In the ancient world, kings were the sages of wisdom, the patrons of wisdom. Think of Solomon. Yet here are the kings with nothing to say in the presence of this disfigured man. And then we come back full circle. They are silent before him. They are submissive to him. He is therefore exalted over them. The one mangled is now magnified. The one humbled is now exalted. Do you see the enigma? Success through suffering. Salvation, sprinkling through suffering. Submission of the nations through suffering. It is not in spite of his suffering that he is exalted. It is because of his suffering that he is exalted. And that's Isaiah 53 in a nutshell. Chapter 52, verse 13 to 15 is like the overture. It's a summary of the whole chapter, the next chapter. Here is a suffering servant who succeeds in bringing salvation to the nations through his suffering. That's what we'll see as we go through chapter 53. There are four stanzas in chapter 53, verse 1 to 3, 4 to 6, 7 to 9, and 10 to 12. The first and third stanzas, verse 1 to 3 and 7 to 9, state simple facts about the servant. And then the second and the fourth stanzas, verse 4 to 6 and 10 to 12, state the significance of the facts. So in the first stanza, we have the simple fact that this servant is despised and rejected, verse 3. Then in stanza 2, we have the significance of that fact. Look at verse 4 and 5. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Verse 5. But he was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes we are healed. That's a statement of significance. It's an interpretation of the facts. And then in the third stanza, we have the simple fact of his innocence. He is an innocent sheep, an innocent lamb. And verse 9, though he had done no violence, there was no deceit in his mouth. Simple fact. And then the fourth stanza, verse 10 to 12, the significance of that fact. Verse 11, out of the anguish of his soul, he shall see and be satisfied. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, the innocent one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. So it goes fact, significance, fact, significance. And as we move through these four stanzas, the servant moves from being passive to active, passive to active. And we'll see that as we go. So let's look at the four stanzas of this enigmatic servant. Number one, he was despised by us. He was despised by us, verses 1 to 3. The opening questions here are rhetorical. Who has believed what they heard from us, and to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Answer, no one. No one's believed this message about this suffering servant. No one has seen the arm of the Lord in his life. That's what's surprising. And why have they not seen it? Well, because of what he was like, verse 2. For he grew up before him like a tender plant and like a root out of dry ground. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. His life actually begins quite well, quite positively. Verse 2, he grew up before him like a young plant, like a root out of dry ground. He had a promising start, even though the conditions, the dry ground in which he grew up, were poor and obscure, even though he was born into a world of flawed humanity. Nevertheless, he grew, he sprouted, he made his own way in life. And while his background was poor and obscure, it was nevertheless royal. Those images of a tender plant, a young plant, or a root. Do you remember what they recall from chapter 11? The shoot from the stump of Jesse, the root of Jesse. Those are royal terms for a royal son. So this servant had a decent start in life. He's a bit like Prince George, beautiful little boy who people are interested in to hear the news about him. So why did people not want to believe the message about him? Well, because of what we read next. He had no form or majesty that we should look at him, and no beauty that we should desire him. As he got older, he got uglier. As he entered the real world and the public life, he became less likable, less desirable. His physical appearance was unattractive, which is surprising given his heritage. Saul, David, Solomon, all described in the Bible as handsome men. David, we're told, was a man of form. Look what this servant has. No form. No beauty. Nothing nice about him. If you saw him in a crowd, you wouldn't take a second look at him. Perhaps he had sticky-eyed ears, big nose, a monobrow, an odd-shaped face. Perhaps his teeth were all badly aligned. We don't know. But we do know that there was nothing attractive about him. And because of this, he was despised and rejected, verse 3. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. That doesn't mean he was generally a sad person. Rather, it means that he felt the debilitating effects of sin, not in his own life, but living in a fallen world. Grief in a fallen world was his constant companion. A man of sorrows and acquainted with grief, literally known by grief. Do you want to know what the servant is like? Go knock on the door of grief. Because grief was his best friend. He was known by grief. He was lonely. Men hid their faces from him. The face speaks of favor, approval, all the basic needs for a human personality to grow and mature. There are things like acceptance, esteem, approval, acknowledgement, friendship. None of these were afforded to him. He was starved psychologically of what most of us take for granted. No emails in his inbox. He had a Facebook account with no friends, no requests. And this was not just by the world, by his own people, verse 3. He was despised and we esteemed him not. This is the first thing we hear about this enigmatic servant. He was despised by us. That's the fact. Now we come to the second stanza, to the significance. He was punished for us, verses 4 to 6. He was punished for us. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. That recalls verse 3, where we read that he was a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. Again, this isn't physical sickness or a sad mood. It's the debilitating effects and consequences of living in a fallen world. But note the shift from the passive to the active voice. In verse 3, it's what we did to him. He was despised and rejected by men. Men hid their faces from him. We esteemed him not. It's what we did to him. He's passive. Now verse 4, surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. He's active now. What's his response to our despising him? He bears our griefs. What's his response to our rejecting him? He carries our sorrows. But there's a bit of irony in verse 4. Surely he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God, and afflicted. This gives us a bit of a glimpse into the pre-understanding of these witnesses. At first, verse 3, they don't esteem him, because they thought he was stricken, smitten, afflicted by God for some sin in his life. That's why we didn't esteem him. Exactly what Job's friends did when they saw him suffering. Job, you're suffering because you've got some sin in your life. Well, that's what these witnesses thought. We esteemed him stricken and smitten by God and afflicted because he must have some sin in his life. And yet, the beginning of verse 4, he has borne our griefs and carried our sorrows. Do you see it? They've experienced a conversion, a change in their perspective. And we can identify with them, can't we? Once I was blind, but now I see. That's what's going on here. And what they now see is there in verse 5. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace, and with his stripes we are healed. The reference here to wounds, crushed, stripes, they all speak of a violent death. But what is the significance of this death? What's its purpose? Well, some Christians and churches like to say that Jesus' death was just an example of self-sacrificing love. Jesus gave us this wonderful example of how to love people. He just went and died for them. That's a bit like me taking Jackie for a romantic walk down the River Cam, turning to her, gazing into her eyes and saying, Jackie, I love you. I love you so much. I would give my life for you. And then I'd jump in the River Cam and drown myself. It's not love. It's lunacy. Other Christians like to say this is a death, not by example, but for empathy. Jesus dies like this so that our hearts go out to him to join the cause, like some hunger striker, stirring people to action by their suffering. But Jesus' death here was not a death by example. It was not a death for empathy. It was a death of substitution. It was a substitutionary death. Notice how the personal pronouns, he, him, his, are all matched by the pronouns are, we, us. The servant is someone who does something for us, in our place, instead of us. He was wounded for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. Upon him was the chastisement that brought us peace. And with his stripes, we are healed. An exact substitution, which is made even more clear in verse 6. All we, like sheep, have gone astray. We have turned everyone to his own way. And the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all. The picture here is God enters the fray like a high priest, like the priest in the Old Testament. And he places his hands on the servant's head and transfers all the iniquity to him. Alec Mateer puts it beautifully, from north, south, east, west, from past, present, future, the divine hand gathers in the sins of all sinners he proposes to save and personally conducts them to a solemn and holy spot, the head of his servant. Which means that verse 4 contains some irony. Just glance back. Yet we esteemed him stricken, smitten by God and afflicted. And now we realize, yes, he actually was stricken, smitten, and afflicted by God. But just not for his own sin. For our sins. Because we all, like sheep, went astray. We turned everyone to his own way. See, there's no wriggle room here about the significance of his death. This is not a death by example. It is not a death for empathy. It is a death of substitution. Jesus didn't die to win our pity. He died to win our immunity. The chastisement that brought us peace was upon him. He didn't die to give us or bring us an example. He died to bring us healing. By his stripes we are healed. He died a death of substitutionary atonement. And it was a complete atonement, comprehensive, because every word of the Old Testament that's used to describe sin, verse 5, transgression, verse 5 and 6, iniquity, verse 10, sin, those three words are the three words the Old Testament uses to speak of our sin in a comprehensive way. And here is this servant taking upon himself our transgression, our iniquity, our sin. Our transgressions, our trespasses of a law, our iniquities, our wanderings off the path, our sin, our missing the mark. Every kind of rebellion is covered by the death of this servant. There's no porn site that you've been on that he didn't bear the punishment for. There's no covetous glance at another married man that he didn't bear the punishment for. No outburst of anger, no moment of childhood rebellion, no misdemeanor at work. Everything is accounted for. Everything we have ever done laid on the head of this servant. He was punished for us, for our iniquities. And third, he was innocent, unlike us. He was innocent, unlike us, verses 7 to 9. He was despised by us. He was punished for us. And third, he was innocent, unlike us. Here we return to the simple facts. Remember, fact, significance. Here are the simple facts. The fact of the servant's innocence. And here he is pictured as a sheep going to the slaughter, a young lamb before its shearers. Notice the image of sheep continues from verse 6. We all like sheep have gone astray. We've turned everyone to his own way. But this sheep, he didn't go astray. He hasn't wandered. He's the innocent sheep. He's the righteous one in verse 11, which makes his silence here all the more noticeable. Because what he is experiencing in oppression, affliction, oppression and judgment is injustice. Yet he opens not his mouth. Three times we're told he opens not his mouth. Here is a sheep, here is a lamb without blemish coming to help the wandering sheep. We're told three times he's innocent in reference to his mouth. Why the emphasis on the mouth? Well, because out of the overflow of the mouth, the heart speaks. And James says, if anyone does not stumble in what he says, he is a perfect man. And here is the perfect man. Because mouths reveal hearts. And under the most intense pressure of oppression and injustice, what does this servant say? Nothing. No outburst in anger, no words of curse or revenge, no deceit. His silence revealed his innocence. His muteness revealed his righteousness. Same with his actions, verse 9. He did no violence. Even when they beat him with the stripes, even when they crush him, he never clenches his fist in response. On the other end of a violent death, he had no clenched fist, only an open hand, in silence, ready to be nailed. His innocence is seen in his burial as well. To the outward eye, he's buried with the wicked. He looked guilty. He was numbered with the transgressors, verse 12. Yet look where he is buried. Not actually with the wicked, but with a rich man. A symbol of honor. In the ancient world, criminals were never buried in a rich man's grave. But he was. Why? Because he was innocent, unlike us. He was a sheep like us, but we have all gone astray. He was a sheep, unlike us, because he didn't go astray. He was a lamb without blemish. And so he became the sacrificial lamb, verse 8. He was cut off out of the land of the living, stricken for the transgression of my people. He was innocent, unlike us. He was despised by us. He was punished for us. He was innocent, unlike us. And fourth, he will succeed for us. He will succeed for us. Verses 10 to 12. And here we're back to the significance of the servant's work. He succeeds for his people. And the reason he succeeds is there in verse 10. Yet it was the will of the Lord to crush him. He, God, has put him to grief. The word will here is literally delight. Yet it was the delight of the Lord to crush him. Now, some people like to play on a statement like this and say this is cosmic child abuse. And it would be if the servant was crushed against his will. But he went willingly to his death. The sheep didn't kick on its way to the slaughter. The sheep didn't bleat in protest. He opened not his mouth. He was willing to go. And God delighted to crush him. Now there's a paradox, if ever there was one. The servant is willing to go, and the Lord is willing to crush. There's no tension here, because the will of the servant and the will of the Lord are hand in hand, like a father and a son walking in the same direction, holding hands. There's only harmony here, and more than that, there's mystery. Alec Matir again, it is not for us to blunder with clumsy steps into such territory, but to fall down in wonder, love, and praise. Because as the servant dies, the Lord delights. Why? Because of what the servant's death produces. Because of what his death secures. Because of how he succeeds through his suffering. And we see four things from his death. He provides atonement for sin, verse 10, when his soul makes an offering for sin. He lives after his death. He shall see his offspring. He shall prolong his days. The word resurrection is never mentioned in Isaiah 53, but it might as well have been. Because after his death, he has offspring and long days, and he is active and dominant. Third, he applies his work, verse 11. By his knowledge shall the righteous one, the innocent one, my servant, make many to be accounted righteous, and he shall bear their iniquities. And fourth, he enjoys his victory, verse 12. Therefore, I will divide him a portion with the many, and he shall divide the spoil with the strong. He is like a conquering warrior dividing up the spoils of his victory. Which brings us back to the exaltation with which this passage begun. 52 verse 13. Behold, my servant shall prosper. Do you see the movement? From weakness to strength, from death to life, from dereliction to salvation, from defeat to victory, from rejection to exaltation. And why does he end up being exalted? Not in spite of his death, but because of his death. That's why he succeeds. That's the enigma. The servant succeeds because he suffers. Behold my servant. He will prosper. He is high and exalted. Why? Because he became more marred than any man. Do you see the enigma? The arm of the Lord revealed in apparent weakness. But in reality, it is strength. In apparent defeat, but in reality, it's a victory. What the world views as foolish and weak, God views as wise and strong. He chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise. He chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. That's the enigma at the heart of the Christian gospel. One Christian commentator has said, Isaiah 53 seems to have been written at the very foot of Golgotha. How true, because this servant, of course, is Jesus Christ in shadow form. He is a type of Christ. And everything we have seen tonight is a picture of Jesus Christ. If we had time, I would show you the three offices of Christ. He is a prophet, the arm of the Lord revealed. He's a priest, verse 10, offering a guilt offering for sin. He's a king, verse 50, chapter 52, verse 13. He is high and exalted. He's of royal lineage. In this chapter, we see his life in his appearance. We see his death, violent, wounded, crushed, stripes. We see his burial in a rich man's grave. We see his resurrection. He sees his offspring and enjoys prolonged days. We see his ascension, high and lifted up. We see his intercession for transgressors. You see it? The life, death, burial, resurrection, ascension, and intercession of Jesus Christ, all contained in this chapter. And God says to us tonight, behold my servant, Jesus. Behold him. It's the wisdom of God. What is foolishness to the world is wisdom to the believer. And the question we need to ask ourselves tonight as we close is, do we believe it? Who has believed what they heard from us? And to whom has the arm of the Lord been revealed? Because some people are like that unknown graffiti artist who mocked Alexamenos. They look at the cross, they look at Jesus, and they say, what a joke. Donkey-headed figure on a cross. What foolishness. Cosmic child abuse. It's how the witnesses in verse 3 initially saw him. We esteemed him not. But for those who have eyes to see, a Savior, the wisdom of God. Do you see it? Because what you see does not determine who Jesus is. It determines who you are. There's the story of the hippies traveling through Paris in the 1970s, and they stopped over in one of the museums at which some of the great works of art were held. And as they're standing there half drunk, mocking these paintings, an official in the museum heard them and heard their mockery and walked up behind them and said, sirs, in this museum, it is not the paintings that are being judged. And when you look at the cross of Christ, you are not judging him, determining who he is. He's determining who you are, whether you have eyes to see or whether you're blind. So let me ask you, are you like Alexamenos, worshipping your God at the foot of this cross? Or are you like the graffiti artist that thinks it's a joke?